Okay. Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. Thank you. We now turn to the final perek, Daf Chaf Vav. We have till Daf Lamed Aleph. Lamed Aleph is one Amud as opposed to a whole Daf, and it's a kind of portion of an Amud. So we've got not too far to go. As I said, we'll do today, next week. I imagine it'll be a busy day next week, so I'll make sure we don't take too long. And then we're not going to meet during Chol HaMoed. We won't meet the Sunday right after Pesach, give people a chance or a way to travel around and such things. And then we'll meet again. Often we'll have four or five, I can't remember. I think it's four because one week I'll be away, meetings leading. And hopefully we'll finish right before Shavuot, the Sunday right before Shavuot. We can do a Siyum. I think it's Yom Yerushalayim that day as well. I think maybe that's the 5K run is that weekend.
That's Memorial Day weekend, right?
I haven't seen the ads yet.
Say again?
I haven't seen the ads yet.
That was it. start practicing. Yeah, so we'll... the run's not on the Sunday, right?
It is.
Oh, so maybe...
I'll see a Sunday or usually Memorial Day weekend.
Like in the morning?
No.
Afternoon?
No, the run's in the morning, right? 9 o'clock.
Oh, okay, so maybe we'll...
I don't think, unless you have it earlier.
No, so we'll maybe we'll do it on Shavuot or something. I'll figure something out. We'll touch base. Maybe we can. Maybe I'll do the Duff while I'm running, and that would be a nice little way of... I'll put on one of those GoPros, and we'll do it.
Sunday is Yom Yerushalayim.
Right.
That's Sunday?
Yes.
And it's Memorial Sunday. Okay, we'll...
With the facing car in front of you, and they'll have a camera.
Yeah, that's good. If we can think of more ways for me to look ridiculous, I'll get on board. Great. So we turn from three parakim, and if we were to overview very briefly, the first parak again, we began by asking, when do you say Mashiv HaRuach? We made our way to say, when do you stop saying V'teintal Umata? When do you start saying V'teintal Umata? It was very much about liturgical ritual, responding to needs for rain, but it was like, in an average year, how do we orient ourselves toward our needs? The second chapter, there was one Mishnah. The first, there was five. The second and the third and the fourth, there's only one Mishnah, which Chazal kind of stick at the front of the perek and then reflect on it, suggesting that there is a combination of one theme that emerges from this discussion in each perek. So the first we noted was the kind of the ritual breakdown of life. The second was about how were these fars done in the times of yesteryear, when they would gather into the town square, they'd bring out the Aaron, they'd put ash on the Aaron, ash on the leader's head. What would they chant? Someone would stand in front of the people and chastise them, give speeches, inspire them. And we said that was kind of a look from ritual to history. And then Pirkei de Chasida, the third parak we did, was tale after tale after tale of pious people and Providence weaving its way and sometimes not weaving its way into their lives. And it was what we characterized as mystery, where there's got to be some pattern, but we're not always cued into it. And we understand and recognize that the core trigger to Providence is relates to our behavior and our piety, not like a preference on the part of God. And that was... the keyhole through the life of Choni Hamagol, who's referred to as a Ben Bayit, who kind of misbehaves in front of God and ends up getting God's favor. And Shimon ben Shadrach says, I would excommunicate you, but God seems to like you, suggesting that we don't always understand God. And then we have stories about Choni Hamagol being pious and suggesting the sages may have misunderstood his central piety. And then we led off and we finished, as you can see, the top of Chaf Vav Amud Aleph. The last word of the perek was... Shechris, so we're talking about drunkenness. And we're now going to pivot from a sense of mystery and dislocation and obscurity on the world to trying to get a sense of clarity. I've found it somewhat challenging to try and string together a singular theme from the Mishnah we're going to read today, so I'd be very happy to hear suggestions, but it seems to me what we're going to look at is a kind of lens on the ups and downs of life. We're going to talk about the worst times and in quite a Dixonian way, and the best times. We're going to look at the most horrific days in the Jewish calendar, which are Tisha B'Av, Shiras HaBetamuz, and the best days on the Jewish calendar, which are Yom Kippur, my birthday, and
Tu B'Av.
And kind of as I say that out loud, it's worth noting this is Masechet Tarnit. We've been debating what aesthetic behaviors are, and the best day and the worst day are both often compared ritually. You've got Tisha B'Av and you've got Yom Kippur. One is one of the worst days, one of the best days. Maybe the suggestion is that we can bridge our behaviors, and in many ways it's about attitude, and we're going to see some of the behaviors along the way. So we're going to do the Mishnah. There are going to be moments in this Mishnah that are not clear, and I could take the time to explain them the way the Gemara does, or we could wait till we get to the Daf where the Gemara explains it. So we're going to go through, we're going to leave some unanswered questions, and then when we get to the Gemara's reflections, we'll resolve them. I've tried to divide it up as per coloring, as usual. Let us begin. B'shlosha prakim b'shana. At three junctures in the year, kohanim nosa imet kapehem arba pa'amim bayom. There are three times during the year when kohanim lift their hands up four times a day, meaning they do duchening four times a day. What are the four times? B'shachrit, b'musaf, b'mincha, v'nilat sha'arim. Those are the four times. Why is Ne'ilah called Ne'ilat Sha'arim? Anybody know? Why is that prayer called Ne'ilat Sha'arim? Which gates? Excellent. Shari Tefillah. Right. So it actually, it's a debate in the Gemara whether it is the gates of heaven are closing, or it's because it was recited when they were closing the gates of the temple. It was kind of nighttime. And we, from our little market research, we see which view seems to have won. In terms of public awareness, and I would put myself in that same boat until I have reviewed this material. So there are four times during the day. Now, I guess the question we'll ask when we start the Gemara is, do we have Musaf on fast days, usually? No. So we're about to say, what are the, other than Yom Kippur, correct. So we're going to have, now, elucidate, what are the three times during the year where Kohanim lift their hands four times? Tani Ot, Ma'amad Ot, of Yom Kippur. So on Yom Kippur, on during the Ma'amad, which we'll explain in a moment, and on Tarnit. And the Gemara is going to say, hold on a minute, there's no Musaf other than Yom Kippur, there's no Musaf on Tarnit. Why are you saying four times a day? So you're going to have to recalibrate what it means. But we're going to say there is a maximum time of four times a day that a Kohanim can do Nisiyat Kapayim, and it happens potentially three times a year. Now we've explained the three, but that whole yellow chunk is going to be explaining what is a Ma'amad. We've related to it in the second chapter, kind of in passing, when we were talking about how do they used to fast, and we said, what did the Ma'amad do? Could they drink? Could they not drink? And the Mishmar we spoke about mainly. And here we're going to outline what that is. Then we're getting in the gray, we're going to have what are the worst things that happened on Tisha B'Av and Shiras HaBetamuz. In the green over the page, we're going to have a reflection on what the beginning of Av looks like. And then we're going to have in the yellow to finish off the Mishnah, what was the great days we noted. And then the Gemara will begin asking some questions. Elohein Ma'amado, the Mishnah says, okay, you've now said the three junctures when Kohanim would do duchening four times a day include the Ma'amad, so let's explain what Ma'amad is. Elohein Ma'amado, these are Ma'amad. Lefish Ne'emar, it says in the verse, Tzavet B'nei Yisrael, et kabbi lachmi, etc. We say this in the daily Korbanot and Tamid. We say, command the Jewish people that they will bring their Korban. And this is in the plural, saying they will bring a Korban. The Korban Tamid is a public offering on behalf of the entire nation. V'chi, the Mishnah says, Heich korbano shall Adam kara vehu eina umel agabav. How could it be possible that someone will have a korban brought and they won't stand there? And this is taken as a given that if you're bringing a korban, you have to be there and watch it and kind of supervise it. You can't outsource your sacrifice. So how could you have a public offering if the public isn't there? So how do you resolve that? C-SPAN. Without C-SPAN, how do you have everybody watching? Hitkinu nevim harishonim, the early prophets decreed, Esrim va'arba mishmarot. I'll call mishmar v'mishmar hayamamad. B'yushalayim shel kohanim shel levim shel yisraelim. The early prophets decreed there would be 24 divisions of the kohanim. We would call the mishmar. We spoke about that. The families kohanim would be divided in 24. And corresponding to each of the 24 mishmarot, there were 24 ma'amadot, which was the entire Jewish people would be divided up into 24. And on rotation, there would be a mixture of kohanim, levim, and yisraelim who would go up and do two things. One is they would stand in Yushalayim and watch. So everybody would have, it seems, everybody would have like a number and you'd be drafted to take some time to stand in the Bet Mikdash representing your family or the people. And we'll, in addition, this is now the second wide line, He gives man ha-mishma la'alot. When it came for the time for the mishma to go up, not only would you have the ma'amad in Yerushalayim, but karnim levim olem Yerushalayim, the karnim levim would go up to Jerusalem, the Yisrael shabot ha-mishma mitkanasim la'areihem. In addition to having a ma'amad in Yerushalayim, it sounds like the ma'amad of Yisraelim, of commoners, would enter their cities for Korin b'masa bereshit, and they would read the creation chapter. And if I were to ask you, you know, what is the most moving piece of scripture, of Tanakh, that you would read when you're bringing the Korban, I'd imagine you'd pick something from Vayikra, maybe something from the end of Shemot with the building of the Mishkan, you'd find something pertinent, maybe the final speeches of Moshe when he speaks to the people as they're about to embark on a journey into the land, and the Gemara will address why the creation narratives as being pertinent for bringing the public sacrifice. But we'll get to that soon. Now in the brackets, so we've said you've got the 24 sections of Kohanim, 24 sections of the Jewish people. Some of them would stand to watch, and some of them would read. And these are some of the earliest practices we have of synagogue life in ancient temple times. There are questions about when did synagogue life and liturgy become routinized throughout the land, as opposed to there just being a central temple, a Bet Mikdash, and people would, you know, pray on occasion when they need, but having a formalized, we see that already here, that they would gather and they'd read Maaseh Bereishit on behalf of their town. In brackets, v'anshei ha'mamad ha'imatanim arbim yamim v'shvuah, and the ma'amad, these Jews who were representing the people, would fast for 4 out of 7 days each week. Miyom bet vad yom chamishi, they would fast from Monday to Thursday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and it's understood this is not the all-day fast, but from dawn to dusk. So they wouldn't eat or drink during the day. V'lahu matanim erev Shabbat, they wouldn't fast on Friday, but they covered Shabbat because of dignity of Shabbat. They shouldn't go into Shabbat exhausted, starving, and kind of having lost their head. V'lo be'echa b'Shabbat, and they wouldn't fast on Sunday either. Why?
Bagels.
Obviously. Kadesh lo, that's why we have bagels now. Kadesh lo yatsu mimnucha v'oneg le'igiyah v'tanit v'yamutu. So they shouldn't transition straight out of rest and joy straight into toil and fasting and die. That may sound hyperbolic. It probably is intended to be hyperbolic, but the assumption is transitioning Shabbos is a day of rest and calm, and transitioning straight into a fast day. Some have read it as it being kind of physiologically unhealthy, psychologically unhealthy. We do have this where there will be, you know, Sunday fast days. The one that we kind of know mostly is Tisha B'Av. Sometimes Din Chayam to a Sunday, you go straight from a Shabbos into a fast day. But kind of on a weekly routine, we wouldn't have that. And now the next two lines of the Gemara is going to say, what would they read for Maaseh Bereishit on each day? But Yom Rishon on Sunday, the Ma'amad would read Bereishit v'Yirakiyah from the beginning until the verse v'Yirakiyah. V'Sheni Yirakiyah v'Yikavu Amayim, they'd read the next section. V'Shlishi Yikavu Amayim v'Yimarot on Tuesday, they would read that section. V'Revi Yimarot v'Yishvitu Amayim on Wednesday, they would read from the creation of the lights until the waters were writhing. The Chamishi on Thursday, Yishvitu Amayim, they'd read from that. V'Tosei Aretz until you had the vegetation sprout. V'Shishi on Friday, V'Tosei Aretz, you'd read from Reshev V'Chol Shamayim until the end of creation. Full stop. So that's how you divide it up. There was no reading on Shabbos because Shabbos you'd have regular laning. But during the week, that's what they would read from Bereishit. Parsha Gedola, Karinoto B'Shnayim V'Ktanam B'Yachid. And you would divide each day, you would have 5, 6, 7 verses, and you'd split up the large section between two people and the small section to one person, meaning you'd have 3 people, and this is where you have the lachic practice. You can only do a laning if you're going to have 3 different people reading, and there's going to be discussion about what's the minimum amount that each aliyah has to be, and how do you divide 5 between 3, which is kind of some rudimentary arithmetic there we're going to have some issues with. Full stop. V'shachrit v'musaf, Uva Mincha, and there's going to be some complication about whether this is read B'Shachrit V'Musaf, full stop, or B'Shachrit full stop, V'Musaf V'Mincha, but the Gemara is going to say what we'll do, B'Shachrit V'Musaf, full stop. So that's what happens on Shachrit V'Musaf. You do the laning in this way, and you split it up between 3 people. V'Mincha, and this is an interesting thing that we don't really have, maybe I'm wrong, you can correct me, V'Mincha on Mincha, Nichnasim V'Karim Alpihem, they would come into Shul, and they wouldn't publicly lane. They would privately recite the laning to themselves, Kukoronet Shema, in the same way that you read Shema. We do have, I guess Shema is the prime example, where you've got a piece of Torah text that we recite privately to ourselves. We don't take up the Torah scroll to lane it, and that's what they would do at Minchatan. Erev Shabbat b'mincha, on Friday at mincha time, lo nechnasim b'nei kavod Shabbat, they wouldn't get together to do a special ma'amad mincha because you're getting ready for Shabbat. And now we're going to have all the interruptions that would stop the ma'amad from gathering to read and lay ordinarily. Kol yom sheish bo halal, any day there was halal, in ma'amad b'shachris, there would be no ma'amad gathering at shachris because davening would take longer and you've got to prepare to welcome people to the Beit Mikdash, etc. Korban Musaf, Ein b'ne'ilah. If there was a Korban Musaf, you wouldn't have the Mama gathering at Ne'ilah, which we said there were four different davenings, and Ne'ilah wouldn't meet for the Mama if there was a Korban Musaf that day. Why? When can Musaf be bought until? Basically until the end of the day. So you'd be preparing for Musaf quite a lot of the day, so Ne'ilah would be interrupted. Which one would you think would be interrupted before Ne'ilah? Mincha, so we're going to get to a shift in a minute. Korban Eitzim, if there was a Korban Eitzim being brought that day, in the Mincha, you wouldn't have it during Mincha because that would interrupt the flow of the day. Divrei Rabbi Akiva said that. Amla ben Azai responded, Kachir b'shua shonim. This is what Rabbi Yeshua said. He said, Korban Musaf in the Mincha. If it was a Musaf, you wouldn't do Mincha. Korban Eitzim in the Ila. He reversed it to make more chronological flow. Chaz Rabbi Akiva lo kashonim k'ben Azai. So Rabbi Akiva shifted his view and followed the view of Ben Azai. Now we're going to talk about, anyone know what Korban Eitzim was? I've heard about a Korban of animals. When do we have a wood sacrifice? Are you familiar with a wood sacrifice?
It would bring the wood for the Korbanos.
So not every day, but there would be occasions during the year when they would have donations of wood to keep the Beit Mikdash going. Now, my understanding is this was a historically rooted thing. This isn't mandated in the Torah anywhere. But when the Jewish people returned from exile, they rebuilt the Beit Mikdash, they didn't have wood stores. So there were kind of more wealthy families who made the journey who contributed wood. And the way it's phrased by some of the commentators is, and out of deference to them, the Nevi'im decreed that every year they would donate wood. Which as a donor, you think, oh, thank you very much for decreeing that. For my good, and there would be 9 occasions during the year when they would have a special Eitzim parade, basically, and that family would bring wood to the temple, whether they needed the wood or not. It was understood this is a wonderful celebration, and bring the wood, and that parade would interrupt the Ma'amad, because there was too much going on in the Beit Mikdash to, you know, go to the side and sit down and lay. Okay, so... I'm not familiar.
Didn't so, they, like, part of the avoda is some of the kohanim had to check
the wood for worms.
Yeah.
You're ringing bells.
Let's go into the section where the in the basement place where they kept eggs, and which was not really part of the avoda.
Right, the lishkat ha'etzim is at the side.
The side, they looked, they checked it out there first.
Yeah, it's ringing bells. So it may come up. Right. So let's see. Yeah. I've got a vague memory, but it could just be that what you're saying, I'm remembering from a second ago. I'm tired. Could be. So, Zman Anse Kohanim. When would this wood be brought up to the Kohanim? V'ha'am Tisha. There were 9 occasions when the wood would be brought up from the people in the Kohanim. Pe'echad v'nisan. And now we're going to have a list of families. So, I guess it wasn't just, you know, a decree from the sages, but they've been remembered in perpetuity for the family contribution. So, number one, Becha b'Nissan, on day one of Nissan, meaning yesterday, B'nai Aruch ben Yehuda, it was the family of Aruch ben Yehuda who would bring the Eitzim. Eshem b'Tamuz, on the 20th of Tamuz, B'nai David ben Yehuda, it was the children of David ben Yehuda who would bring. And the assumption is they would bring enough wood to last until the next juncture. So actually some families have got more of a burden than others. Bringing them from the 1st of Nissan to the 20th of Tammuz, that's quite a lot of wood. Bringing from the 20th of Tammuz to Chamisha Ba'av is much less wood. B'nai Parosh ben Yehuda, so the children of Frosh ben Yehuda, my maternal grandfather's last name was Frosh, so I assume that's a connection here, although his parents were Frazitsky, so unlikely. B'shiva Bo, on the... Say again?
Were they in the lumber business?
He was in the furniture business. He actually, regretfully, I'll say, he started a company that was basically the IKEA before IKEA started. It was called HomePack. And it was the first thing that you used to take it home and build yourself. And I guess it just didn't have any Swedish meatballs. And it never took off. in the same way. He did fine, but it wasn't an IKEA. B'shiva bo, on the 7th of Av, B'nei Yonadav ben Rachav, it was the children of Yonadav ben Rachav, B'asara bo, on the 10th day, B'nei Sinav ben Binyamin, it was Sinav ben Binyamin, B'chamisha asar bo, on the 15th day, B'nei Zuta ben Yehuda, there was the family of Zuta ben Yehuda, B'imam kavim v'im, B'chomisha tav v'shivtav. And on that day, on the 15th of Av, it included Kohanim Levim and any people who didn't know whose family they came from. Meaning they remember, they've got family law, L-O-R-E, family law, that they used to contribute, but they don't know when it was, and they don't know how. So they would all bring on the 15th of Av, and we'll get to that being one of the highlights of the year, and that's when they would bring. We'll get to what this means. The pestle smugglers and the fig cutters would bring on that day as well. Be'esrim bo, on the 20th day, b'nei Pachat Moab ben Yehuda, it was that family. Be'esrim be'el, on the 20th of Elul, b'nei Edom ben Yehuda, it was the children of Edom ben Yehuda. Be'echad be'tevet, shvo, on the 1st of Tevet, b'no Parosh Shniah, it would be the children of Parosh for a second time they would bring. And as a parenthetical remark, be'echad be'tevet, on the 1st of Tevet, l'ayibah Mamad, there was no Mamad at all. Because we said, if there's a day when there's halal, there's no shachrit, if there's a good of Musaf, there'd be no mincha, there's korban eitzim, there'd be no ne'ilah. On the 1st of Tevet, there is halal, Musaf, and korban eitzim, because we just said that the 1st of Tevet was b'nei Parosh. So you basically have no Mamad that day at all. Why is there halal on the 1st of Tevet, out of interest?
Rosh Chodesh.
There you go. So Rosh Chodesh, why do we do halal on Rosh Chodesh?
Minhag.
It's a minhag, which is why we only do half, and there are debates in the Sfardi about whether you say a bracha on it or not, because it's just a minhag. So that would not disqualify the Mamad, because it's a minhag. So you wouldn't like overrule the Mamad, but because it's halal, so you've got a rabbinic injunction to say halal, that would override. Full stop, end of what the Mamad is. So again, the whole first section of the Mishnah just relates. Three times during the year, Kohanim would do duchening four times a day, including during the Mamad. And then we have all the exceptions when it wouldn't be four times a day. If there is a Korban Eitzim, and then the Mishnah says, oh, you mentioned Korban Eitzim, let's talk about the Eitzim. But fundamentally, the first part is, on a fast day, Kohanim would bless the people. So if we're trying to establish a theme through this Mishnah and through this Perek, it seems to be on fast days, one of the ways that we transcend distance from God is with closeness and intimacy with people. We have the Kohanim lift their hands up four times a day. They try to issue blessings. They try to channel divinity to us. And that, to some degree, is going to be one of the themes beneath the surface of this Mishnah, that there are two planes that we need to succeed as people. One is a relationship with God, and the other is a relationship with other people. And as we're about to outline what are the five terrible things that happened on Shozar B'Tammuz and the five terrible things that happened on Tisha B'Av, it's going to be a mix. Some of it is going to be a dent in our relationship with God, and some of it's going to be a dent in our political life, a dent in our relationship with other people. And we have the Kohanim serving as the conduit, kind of the middlemen, so to speak, when it comes to providence. And that's going to be the theme. And as with almost every Masechet, Mishnayot finish in the same way that rabbis like to finish today. How do rabbis finish every speech usually? Try to?
Amen.
And that is not just a recent tradition because we don't know how to finish. That is a long-standing tradition because we never knew how to finish. I think I may have mentioned to you by J.J. Shach, the one said, thank God for Mashiach, otherwise rabbis would never stop speaking. They'd never know how to end. So that's how we will finish. And it's literally the Mishnah is going to finish, Bimheira of Yomeinu. And that actually is a pattern in many, many Mishnayot, that you kind of deal with the regularities of life, and then it finishes with like, but let's remember what we're aiming for. We have higher aspirations to return to a different kind of regularity. And we'll see that theme again of the two planes, the vertical plane where we're trying to relate to God and the horizontal plane where we're relating to people. So that's the Kohanim at the middle being the juncture between those two axes. In the gray two lines up, there were five things that happened on the 17th of Tammuz and five on Tishbav. B'shiva asar b'Tammuz, what happened on the 17th of Tammuz over the page? Nishtabra lucha, the lucha was smashed. Vatal ha-tamid, the regular korban came to an end. V'hufka ata'ir, the city was breached. V'sarif ha-bastomas et ha-torah, apostomas, the Roman general, burned the Torah. Which Torah did he burn? So there's a So there's different views, some of which he went around burning all the Torahs to try and rid them all, and one is that he particularly took Ezra's Torah and burnt it, which was essentially the authoritative text. It was kept in temple grounds. If there was ever a question about textual variant, they would say, take out Ezra's Torah, and then we'll check there. And he kind of burned that to try and ruin authority and tradition. Vehem itzelem behechal, and there was a tzelem, a idol put up in the temple. So those are the five things of Shiva Sabatamas. Now, most of that seems to be divine-related problems, although burning of the Torah is about how we regulate our lives in connection with God. But Tisha B'Av, what happened on Tisha B'Av, five things, Nigzal Avotav Shalom Kso La'aretz, it was decreed that our ancestors wouldn't enter the land. That was traditionally what happened. This was the spies, they came back with their report, everybody cried, and traditionally God said, right, you're crying over nothing. Let's give you something to cry about. You're not going into the land of Israel. Oh, that was a big mistake. And that happened on Tisha B'Av, traditionally. V'charev Beit HaBayit HaRishon HaRishnia. The two temples were destroyed, so we got three so far. Nilkadar Beitar. Beitar was captured. What was Beitar? Other than now, I think, it has won awards for the tidiest, cleanest city in Israel. It's related to the last stand, indeed, the last stand of the Jews against the Romans. I think it was 52 years after the temple was destroyed. Beitar was captured. It was like a major Jewish town. And it is discussed in the Gemara in Gittin, where we talk about the last stand and what happened there. Miracles that happened in the wake of the destruction. Talking about, I don't know if this has come up onto your scenes on your phones this morning, but as Kyiv is being retaken, parts of it that the Russians take, they're finding roads just strewn with bodies that have been burned and left, and it's kind of horrific. And the Gemara in Gittin speaks about Jews refinding Beitar after the Romans left it, and they found bodies in pristine condition, and how that was seen as a remarkable turn of events, and they were able to bury their loved ones. So we just have a reference here that happened on Tisha B'Av, that Beitar was destroyed, V'nechrashah Ha'ir, and the old city of Jerusalem was plowed over on that day. So a lot of this is about putting dents in our ability to connect with God. They plowed over the temple ground, but this is also about political life. They ruined Beitar. That wasn't about a kind of particularly divine or ritual connection. That was about our ability to live free as human beings. Full stop. Mishenichnas Av Mematim B'Simcha. This is where we get that turn or phrase that when Av begins, we lower our Simcha. And I remember, I'm pretty sure it was Larry who told me, I think it was a couple of years ago, said, you know, the trivia question, when is the happiest day in the year? The happiest day in the year is Erev Rosh Chodesh Av. Because we're told, you know, you should lower your Simcha on the first day of Av. And we're told you should increase your Simcha on the first day of Adar. And it never says when to stop. So on Rosh Chodesh Av, Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, you've got to keep going until it says you should start getting it down. So we'll use that. So Shenech Matzav Mamatim B'Simcha, when Av begins, you should lower your Simcha. And now we're going to have some details. The way we do the 3 weeks now is very different to the way it was originally. And I mean, this is self-conscious in the halacha that it accrues over time. Sfaradim and Ashkenazim practice differently. Limitations. The 9 days is essentially a Ashkenazi concept. For the week of is really the original thought. Shabbat Shechal Tisha B'Av, the week that Tisha B'Av falls, li'abtocha asam l'sapim l'chabes. It is prohibited to cut one's hair and to launder, not money, but clothing. That's always permitted. V'chamishi mutarim b'nei kavada Shabbat, and on the Thursday of that week, you're allowed to wash, and it seems like you're allowed to cut your hair. I will have to talk about this in more detail because Shabbos is coming. Erev Tisha B'Av, but on the day before Tisha B'Av, lo yochal adam shnei tavshilin, a person shouldn't eat two cooked foods, lo yochal basar ish layam, you shouldn't eat meat or drink wine. So we have extended back, don't eat meat and drink wine to 9 days. Sounds like on the day before you shouldn't. So again, this is a self-conscious retracting of these practices, suggesting that kind of we become more mournful as time goes by. Rav Shimon Gamliel says, Yeshana Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda used to teach Mechayev B'Chfiyat Hamita, you have an obligation during the week of, it sounds like, or maybe Erev Tisha B'Av, to overturn your bed. What is overturning the bed? Where else does that, say again? So this comes up in the context of Avelut, where there's a talk of overturning your bed. We don't practice that anymore because we don't really sleep in the same kind of beds, but it would be a way, they used to have beds that you could turn over and it would be less comfortable or closer to the floor. The Chacham didn't agree that you have to do that. And we'll talk about some of these practices. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a long essay where he describes the difference between personal mourning and public mourning, and how in personal mourning, the most intense grief is immediately, and then Chazal find ways to ease it over time. And communal grief is actually, it's not that intense because it's a distant memory, and Chazal designed it to build over time. So you have the inverse where you have, in personal grief, you have Shiva, Shloshim, and then Yud Bayit Chodesh. In communal grief, you start with the 12-month practices through the 3 weeks, and the 9 days is equivalent of Shloshim, and then the week of is equivalent to Shiva, and then you've got the most intense around the time of Tish B'Av itself, which then eases on the back end. Avram Shimon Gamliel says, Lo hayu yamim tovim lizroa b'chamisha asaba avichi yom kippur. You want to talk about bad days? Let's finish this Masechet, talking about providence, our relationship with God, the fact that we've experienced loss, the fact that we haven't achieved full recompense. Let's finish with some notions of celebration. And there were no days as happy as Tu B'Av and Yom Kippur, which, as we said, is a fast day. So don't think that fast days have to be, by definition, horrific occasions. What happened on those days? Shebehem benot Yushalayim Yotzeit. On those 2 days, what was it that characterized them as so good? The daughter of Israel would go out with Lilavan in white clothing, Shu'ulin, they had borrowed. Shalivai Shemisha Enlo, so no one would be embarrassed, and they'd go out in their, Gucci is a company, I think, right? Clothing, not a car. So they're not going to go out and, like, some people have Gucci, some people have Primark. I don't know if you're aware of what Primark is. You know what Primark is? Unbelievable. So Primark is a company in England, which I don't know how they do it. I'm sure there's some child labor involved. But they've got very, very cheap clothing. And I don't know if any of you have daughters or sons who have friends who are girls.
I just got a package from England for my kids.
There you go. So the girls who study in Israel, they learn from their English friends about Primark, and they always try to have a stopover in London so they can go and buy Primark. And I just heard, if you're really interested, which you're probably not, is that the American Dream Mall just opened the first American branch of Primark. Very exciting. That's a Sunday. There you go. So you can get kosher food, gummy bears, and Primark. Either way, so on this day, on Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av, they would all borrow white clothing to go out into the fields to dance around. And it would be borrowed, so nobody had to be embarrassed about who had what brand. Kola kelim to unim tvila, and all of them would require immersion. Uvnot Yushalayim Yotzeh v'chol v'kramim, and the daughters of Jerusalem would go out and v'cholot v'kramim, and they would dance in the vineyard. Umahayu omrot, and what would people say? And this was the earliest version of why you connect, or saw you at Sinai and trying to set up pairings, and we could, of course, apply a historical lens to how things tend not to work this way anymore. They didn't have, you know, shidduch resumes in the same way, and it is very much that the girls were put on display and the men would choose. But this is what was said to the men as they were standing there watching this procession. They would say, and this has been read in different ways, and we'll try to put our take on this. Bachor, they would say, young man, Sana inech or ema taborelach. They would say to the young man, lift up your eyes and pick what is fitting to you. So it sounds like they're saying to the young man, take your choice. And then there's another phrase, al titen inecha benoi. Don't put your eyes upon beauty. Ten inecha b'mishpacha, but look at family. Now what does that sound like the recommendation is when they're saying, okay, as you're choosing, don't look at beauty, look at family. What does it sound like they're recommending one pays attention to? Sounds like it's saying, pay attention to yichus. Don't think about, you know, who's most pretty person right now. Think about who comes from a good family. I guess another way to look at this would be, when you're considering a partner, don't think about who is most aesthetically enticing, but think about who's going to be the best partner in building a family. That's not going to be the way the Gemara reads it, but that's the way we'll read it until we get to the Gemara. Sheker hachein, behevel hayofi. Grace is lies. Beauty is vanity. Isha yirat Hashem italal, a woman who fears God, that is to be praised. So this is kind of like, what are your priorities in making a relationship? And this is seen as a prism that when we're thinking about relationship with God, this is not just, oh, you're talking about happy days, let's mention what happened, but this is how we're finishing our reflection on providence, which is ultimately a question of relationship building. How do we relate to God? And the suggestion is it shouldn't be through the narrow lens of temptation or material inducement. This should be about forming relationship, building the future, not focused on Yofi and Chen, but focused on Yira and building societies that function through altruism. The Omer, and it also says, and it sounds like Rav Shmuel Gamliel saying, and we would also say to the young men, Tanu lamit priyadeha, you should give her from the fruit of her hand, Galilu b'sharim ma'aseh, and it is her deeds that should be praised in the gates. We want someone who doesn't just look good, but someone who does good, someone who can build family. You want to have a reliable partner in life. V'chein hu Omer, and it also says, Tsena urena benot Zion, go out and see the daughters of Zion, B'melech Shlomo. Look at the King Solomon. When wonder where this verse is taken from? Shir HaShirim. Where it says, go and look at King Solomon. Who is King Solomon they're being told to look at? Sounds like he's talking about King Solomon. But Chazal read it as Rashi points out here, if you look almost immediately to the left, a couple lines up in Rashi, B'melech Shlomo, B'melech Shahashalom Shalom. It's talking about the king who owns peace. Melech Shlomo, the king who has peace. Who's the king who has peace? Ultimate king. So it could be Mashiach. I think this is going to be read as God. So the king of all peace, you should look up at him. And this is going to be the key ending to a Masechet on Providence. You should look up, daughters of Zion, at the king of peace. Be'itra she'itra lo imo, the crown that king has that was put on by its mother. God has a mother? This is, let's not go down that road. But they're saying God has a, meaning somebody crowns God. So when we talk about we need God, it sounds like God actually needs something else. B'yom chatunto, on the day of the king's wedding. B'yom simchat lebo, on the day of the king's joy. So we're now describing God in almost very material terms as having highlights. A day of betrothal and a day of deep joy. And it is on those days that the mother of the king coronates the king. But Yom Chatunto, what is the day of that king's greatest betrothal? Zeh Matan Torah. That is Matan Torah. And it sounds like we as a people gave God power. Because what did we do? We accepted it. We said, we will take this. Na'aseh v'nishma. So we finish this reflection on providence with Rav Shmuel Gamliel says, you want to know the key of providence? We do it. We give God power. We kind of make ourselves dependent all the time and we turn to God in need and we have ta'aniyot, but we should recognize that we're also in a position where we give God power and we've got responsibility to do that. What is B'yom Simchat Libo? What is the greatest day of God's joy? So we've got the giving of the Torah, but that's a historical event. That's a one-off. None of us can kind of revisit that. But what is the greatest day of God's joy? Binyan Beit Mikdash, the building of the temple, which is a way that God interacts with us and we interact with him every single day. B'mher shibanavit, b'mher yameinu, amen, may be speedily built in our days. Amen, Kiddush. That's the end of the Mishnah. B'shlosha prakim, the Gemara begins. Okay, the Gemara says we've got this long Mishnah, we're going to go through this run when we're going to land this Masechah. B'shlosha prakim, b'shana kohanim noisim mekabeim. There are three times during the year when kohanim would lift their hands, four times a day. So the Gemara says, hold on a minute. Taniot umamadot miyakamusaf. You said that four times a day on these three occasions, and of those three occasions, two of them don't have a musaf. So what are you talking about? Chasur merzvak tani. Gemara says, okay, it was being brief. It was a Mishnah. Let's unpack what it really meant to say in full. B'shlosha prakim kohanim. There were three times when kohanim nesek kabim would lift their hands. Kol zman shemit palim. Every time they would daven. However many times a day that was. Yeshmen arba pamim bayom. And there were some occasions where every time you daven that day would be four times. Shachrit musaf minchan ila, sharim full stop. And meaning, what is the time where you would daven four times a day? Yom Kippur. But the other two, you wouldn't. Meaning, maximally, there was a time during the Eokanim do duchening four times a day, but three times a year, they would do it every time they davened. And what are those three? Ve'elun shosh prakim, tanyu maman of Yom Kippur, full stop. Amr of Nachman says, now that the Mishnah said that, we're going to say that actually this was a matter of debate. There were some views that you never do a Nasiat Kapayim at Mincha. There were some views you never do Nasiat Kapayim at Ne'ilah. When do we nowadays do duchening? We don't do it at Mincha. We do it at Musaf on Yom Tov, basically. Sfardim do it every day. Oh, you're right. In Israel, there are times where they do it every day. Ashkenazim do it every day in Israel?
Yeah.
Gosh, I haven't been there in a while. Yes, indeed. Everywhere?
There's a
Yeah. Wow, I really haven't been in a while. Okay, right. So the understanding, the background, I'm told, is that the Vilna Gaon at one point wanted to inaugurate the daily Duchening, which is why they which is why they do it in Israel, because the Talmidim of the Gra, the students of the Vilna Gaon, were some of the earliest who made waves of Aliyah, and they inaugurated the Minhag of the Gaon, which was to do Duchening every day. The background is he tried to do it back in Vilna, and every time they tried to do it, like the shul burned down. So he just thought, maybe this is a sign I shouldn't do it, and let's try to avoid it. And then we could have a separate shir about talking of providence. At what point do you read meaning into providence? And so the Vilna Gaon is one example where he said, this is the right thing to do, we should do this, but things keep burning down, so let's avoid that. And I think there was a case of the Chatam Sofer who had a view about waiting for certain hours after milk and meat, and he had a milky coffee made 2 hours after, and then it spilled and burnt something. He said, all right, that's a bad idea, we'll keep waiting however long we wait. So there's a backdrop as to how often can you read meaning into providence, and how does that interact with halachic decision making? You can imagine if the Supreme Court was coming up with a verdict and said, I was going to say this, but as I wrote it, the pen broke, so I figured this is probably wrong. So what are you talking about? But that clearly does have a role to play, at least for some of the decisors in halachic life. So this is a matter of debate, how often the Kohanim would do duchening. First word on the line is Sha'arim. We're at the end. Amr of Nachman. Rav Nachman said, Am Rabavu, in the name of Rabavu, Zudiv Rav Meir. That view you've got in the Mishnah here is only Rav Meir that says you would duchen four times a day. Excuse me. Say again. Oh, thank you. Aval Chachamim, but the Chachamim Omer, and the Chachamim disagreed and said, Shachrit of Musaf Yesh ben Nesik, Chachamim Milchanei en ben Nesik. The Chachamim said you'd only do it in the morning, but you'd never do Duchening in the afternoon at Mincha Ne'ila. Man Chachamim, who are these Chachamim that Rav Avu is referring to? Rav Yehuda. It's Rav Yehuda. Full stop, we're now going to have the Braita that has all three views. Ditanya, it was taught in a Braita. Shachrit, Musaf, Mincha, Ne'ila, Kulan Yesh ben Nesik, Kapan, Devar, Meir. Meir says you can do Duchening at each four. And strictly speaking, on Yom Kippur, you would do it at all four. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda disagreed and said, Shachar is Musaf, Yesh Menesir, Kom Menchen Ne'ilah, and Ben Menesir, Mupayim. You do it in the morning, Shachar is Musaf, but not Menchen Ne'ilah. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi says, Ne'ilah Yesh Menesir, Kom, you would do it at Ne'ilah, Mincha Ein Ben Menesir, Kom, but you wouldn't do it at Mincha. So the three different views. Vermeer says you can do Duchening all day long in all four davenings. Chachamim / Rabbi Yehuda, who is identified as Chachamim, says you can do it in the morning, but not in the afternoon. And the final word, Rabbi Yossi says you can do it in the morning, Shachar is Musaf, and you can do it in the afternoon, Ne'ilah, but not at Mincha. Now, the question is going to be, why? What is the debate going on as to why Mincha should be the most controversial one, where someone will say, you can do it anytime, but just not Mincha, and why someone say all of them, and someone would say only in the morning. I'll give you a clue. This can have something to do with the last word of the previous chapter. There's your clue. Rav Meir Savar. B'maika Miflegei. What are they arguing about? That's the first word on the line, B'mai. What are they arguing about? Rav Meir Savar. Rav Meir said, Kol Yoma Tama Mailo Parashikani Yadayhu B'minchata. Hold on a minute. Why don't Kohanim duchen every day at Mincha? We're talking about they can duchen a Mincha on fast days, and there's a debate whether they can or they can't, and the Mamet. Why don't we duchen every day at Mincha? And this is based on the assumption you duchen every day at Shacharis, as they do, as we all know, in Israel. So the question is, why don't we duchen at Mincha? We do Birchat Kohanim often during Mincha on fast days. There you go. Michael's got it. Or he's just thirsty, which is Mishum Shacharis because of drink. And the assumption is people are having lunch, it's coming to Mincha time, over lunch people are going to, whether they're actually intoxicated halachically, legally is another question, but there's laxity, maybe someone will have a beer, maybe someone will have, something's going to make them feel a little less than focused. Ha'idna leka sigrus, but on a fast day, there is no drunkenness. So there's no, of course you can duchen at Mincha. Meaning, ordinarily, we're going to say, don't do duchen at Mincha, because you're going to be a little drunk. And why shouldn't you duchen if you're drunk? Right, well, what does the Pasuk say, Kohanim can't drink, when they do what? When they come into the Bet Mikdash. But if they're duchening in Shulin on the Bet Mikdash, so that's going to be the end of the daf, hold on a minute, saying, well, it doesn't say anything about duchening with Kohanim, it only says, serving the Bet Mikdash, they can't. So we're going to have to draw that connection.
It also must be a lower level of... it can't be shikras, or else
presumably you wouldn't be davening mincha in that state.
Right, this is something that comes up.
How could you pray for other people if you can't
daven for yourself? This comes up on Purim often, when every year someone says, you're allowed to get drunk on Purim. And then someone says, the conversation doesn't even get started because you can't bench if you're halachically drunk. So how could you get drunk in a meal when you know you're going to have to bench and you can't bench if you're drunk? So it must mean that you shouldn't be getting drunk on Purim. It must mean something else. So that's kind of one avenue to resolve the whole issue. But davening when you're drunk, I mean, one solution is you have in mind, I'm going to bench in a minute, and you sleep it off, and then there are different halachic answers. But that's a reasonable claim. And yes, you shouldn't be davening if you're drunk. So how can we say, oh, you shouldn't be duchening? Right, so it could be, let's say they've davened already, they come to shul, and they say, oh, I did mincha, I don't need it. So can they get up and duchen? He would say, well, no, you're drunk. So, well, I'm not going to daven, I'm just going to duchen. So the assumption is, maybe that's one avenue to separate out the issues. So he says, either way, he says on a fast day, Reb Meir says, you can duchen at all of them. There's no worry about people being drunk at mincha, because it's a fast day. And to some degree, these three views are reflective of, and how do we relate to time? If it's Sunday, and it's a fast day, are people worried that if I'm duchening at mincha, people are going to start thinking, oh, you can duchen at mincha every day? Or do people recognize that today is a unique day? It's a fast day. So Reb Meir says, people understand. Ha'idna. Right now, people know it's a fast day, and this is not regular rules. Reb Yehuda Sava, Reb Yehuda thinks, the first one line is b'mincha. So Reb Yehuda Sava, Shacharis and Musaf, Dechol Yom Lo'shchei Shecharis. On Shacharis and Musaf, everybody knows, you know, usual days you're not getting drunk. Lo gaz rabbana, so the rabbis didn't make a decree. Mincha ne'ila kol yom shchicha shechu gaz rabbana. But people said, look, people know it's a fast day today. But if you start duchening at mincha mariv, or mincha ne'ila, people are going to think, oh, you can duchen at mincha ne'ila. And then on a regular day, when people are kind of a little inebriated, they're going to start duchening. And so you need to make a decree. Nothing happens in the afternoon. Rabbi Yossi says, mincha de'ita b'kol yom gaz rabbana. Mincha, that you have mincha every single day. And if you've got mincha every day, people are going to think, what happens at mincha? Oh, I remember on mincha, on the fast day we duchen, so we should duchen every day. So there was a concern the rabbis had about duchening at mincha. But ne'ila delayed b'chol yom, and the fact that you don't have ne'ila every day, the rabbis weren't worried, so you duchen at mincha, ne'ila, because that's not going to be extrapolated to other days. Full stop. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, halacha Rav Meir. So Rav Yehuda Amar Rav says, we follow Rav Meir, which is you duchen four times a day. Rav Yochanan says, and this is where we get some intriguing halachic operations. Rav Yochanan says, Nagu ha'am ka Rav Meir. So we had Rav say, halachas Rav Meir. We got Rav Yochanan says, the people do according to Rav Meir. V'rava ama, and Rav said, minhag ka Rav Meir. Says, no, not the people do, but the custom is like Rav Meir. What is going on here? Mandam halachas Rav Meir. The people who say the halacha follows Rav Meir, darshin alam peruka, that's what we say when we go through the halachas in public. Duchen four times a day. Mandam minag, the people who say that this is a minag, midrash le dashinan, orin marinam. We don't publicize this, but orin marinam, we make that decision. If someone asks us, we tell them, you should do it four times a day. Mandam anagu, but the people who said not that it's a minag, but people do this, orinam marinam. We don't even rule that way if someone asks us. The avid avid, if someone gets up and they start duchening in mincha, lo madrinan they, we don't make them come down. Bottom line, Rav Nachman Avlach Rav Yossi, Valach Rav Yossi. Bottom line, we follow Rav Yossi, which is Shacharis, Musaf, and Ne'ila, nothing at Mincha. That seems to be the bottom line, that you don't do duchening at Mincha. Vaha Idna, and then the Gemara has a very self-conscious question. It says, hold on a minute, you just told me we don't duchen at Mincha. Vaha Idna, but nowadays, my Talmud Parsha Ganid over Mincha Tanito. Kohanim do duchen at mincha on a fast day, which is, someone will have to remind me, here we do the Birchat Kohanim at the end of the Amidah on a fast day. Do they duchen in Israel? Or do they just read that out loud? Recha Hashem v'yishmerecha. They do duchen?
Zip through Ne'ila so that they can do the Birchas Kohanim before Shkia, and then they sit there and drag out Avinu Malkeinu for an hour.
Fun. Right. Right. So I guess, I mean, the truth is, I guess whenever we say Birchas Kohanim liturgically, they're duchening. They're That's what's going on. So he says, you just said we follow Rabbi Yossi. He says, you don't dochen at mincha. So why do we do it at mincha nowadays? I said, well, nowadays, we do mincha quite late in the afternoon. It's close to ne'ila. Meaning, when do we do mincha at shul? We do as close to shkia as possible, so we go straight into Maariv. So it's not like you're doing mincha at 12 p.m. You're doing it at 5, so no one's drunk anymore. People have gone back to work and made all their mistakes at work. Now they can come to daven. Yeah, exactly. They're just hung over. They're not inebriated anymore. Full stop. Dekule alma mihat shikur asa b'nesiyat kapayim. Says, hold on a minute. The bottom line assumption of all of this is, if you're drunk, you can't do duchening. Who says that's true? Menahan emili. Where does that come from? Why do we have the Birchat Kohanim section right next to the Nazir section? Tell you, just as a Nazir can't drink, also a Kohen Duchening can't drink. So it seems to be not based here on the verse that says Yain v'sheicha al tash, that you shouldn't drink wine if you're serving the Bet Mikdash. This is all rooted on a connection between the Nazir and the Kohen Mevarech, which. Right, seems to be that any drink is a problem. This is not about, you know, obviously you can't be drunk because you can't pray, but you shouldn't have drunk anything, it sounds like. But what else can't another have?
Grapes.
Grapes. So maybe a Kohen who wants to duchen can't have grapes. Does that sound extreme?
Yeah.
Well, if that's what you're going to say, maybe the Kohen shouldn't have grapes either. If you compare it to a Nazir, Rav Yitzchak says, no, what it says in the verse, L'sharta l'varach b'shmo, it compares, at one point, where is this? Where this is in Dvarim, that talks about the Kohanim of different functions, blessing the people and serving God. Mama sharto muta b'chartzen, just as a Kohen serving the Bet Midash can have grapes, Av Kohen b'varach muta b'chartzen, so to a Kohen whose blessing can have grapes, and then it's going to, we'll carry on next week, it'll say, well, hold on a minute, so how? Which way is this going? Are you comparing a Kohen giving duchening to a Kohen who is serving the Bet Mikdash or to a Nazir? Those are very different comparisons. And what is the function? And this is partially getting to the core of the theme that we've brought up. Why are we talking about duchening? Is this about serving the Bet Mikdash? Is this about being an aesthetic figure? Is this about being a channel, a conduit to the people? And here's exactly what we're trying to figure out. They can't drink. Why can't they drink? Is blessing the people a function of divine service, or is it a function of human service? Or is it something independent as a ritual? And we're going to get to that as we go along. But in the meantime, we've kind of begun this mission, begun our reflections on the high points and the low points of Jewish life. And we are kind of pivoting towards hope as providence being a way to progress toward our ultimate redemption. Amen.